Now, Germain, are you ready?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, I give you the floor then.
All right, so I'll share my screen. Can you see it?
Yes,
Okay,
perfect.
thank you. Thank you for inviting me in this seminar, and thank you, Lola, for this fascinating first talk. And I'm quite glad because I was afraid that my talk might kind of go over the limit, but Lola has actually addressed some of the things that I was planning to, so I will be able to cut some parts. So, as Benoit said, I'm a social anthropologist, and I've been interested for some years in how urban soils are becoming a matter of concern in the worlds of soil ecology and urbanism, two disciplines that have little to say to one another until recently. But in fact, the fact that we are all here and that this project, Soil Depth, is running proves that it is no longer the case. So I've been doing field work with soil scientists, ethnographic field work with soil scientists, urban gardeners, urban planners, and ground engineers as well, between 2014 and 2018, mostly in the Paris area and in on post-industrial sites in the Lorraine region in eastern France. That was part of my PhD and my first postdoc, and a lot of what I'm going to tell you today is based on that research. So in this talk, I'll follow the thread of anthropogenic soils, more specifically urban soils, so soils that have been deeply transformed by human activities. I find these urban soils fascinating because it's not really clear what counts as soils in a city, and that's one of the things I will talk about. So basically addressing the question that frames this seminar today, what soils, I'll try to say a few things about what soils we're talking about in cities, and how their properties matter. So basically, this very first part is intended as a kind of theoretical framework for what I'm going to say, how I want to address the research questions to which considering soils in cities open up. And that is notably in the framework of the contemporary environmental humanities, so a branch of thinking that has gained traction at the intersection of environmental history, environmental anthropology, and sociology, but also with philosophical insights and literature humanities insights as well. And a lot of the authors in this field suggest that thinking through the current ecological crisis requires us to make way in our stories about the world to other actors than just humans, or just humans' representations and politics. And we've seen fascinating work that has challenged the roots of these humanities by bringing forth stories about birds, plants, or microbes. And you probably know these books by Haraway and Tsing, of course. And in this very exciting theoretical renewal context, one of the questions that me and other scholars are trying to bring about is what can an attention to soil bring, how can the material and cultural specificity of soil provide as insights for the environmental humanities? And if we address soil not just as a resource or as a passive background upon which human activities take place, how does that change our idea of what a city is? And the third book I've put a picture of here actually is a book from 2020 that really follows that thread of thinking with soils within the environmental humanities. So I was going to go through the plurality of definitions that we may have about soils, but actually Lola has been addressing this diversity of soil knowledge, so I'm going to be able to skip through this really quickly. She's mentioned the soil profiles. Maybe I'll just mention a couple of ones that are more specific to how disciplines related to the city, to urbanism, to the urban phenomena, think or look at the soil. So one of them, of course, is the scale of the planner, which with a kind of view from above, where the soil is just this surface to be developed and occupied. Another one is that of the ground engineers, who have their whole set of categories and a very highly developed knowledge about these soils, but actually addressing mostly the mineral part of them in most cases, and with preoccupations related to structural ability of soils. And of course, one of the interesting things is that when you're doing these research in French, the word for soil and the ground are the same one, sol. So basically what you step on and what you cultivate and so on is the same word in French, which is a bit different in Germanic languages and in English. But of course, we're all here because one approach to soil or a set of approach to soil is currently gaining traction, including in the fields of urbanism and planning. And that is, Lola has mentioned it as well, a living soil perspective, or perhaps you could say also an ecological approach to soils. And there are numerous examples of how an attention to soil life or soil biodiversity is currently coming to the front stage in many different respects. So here you've got a picture of the last report, a recent report by the IPBES, which is like basically like the IPCC for Earth ecosystems, which has the dedicated a report to land degradation, addressing also soil biodiversity. You've got the European Atlas of Biodiversity of Soils, and the book on the left is just one important reference in the more scientific realm about that has played a big role in the emergence of this living soil perspective. So, of course, this is largely connected to the growing legitimacy within the soil sciences of the subdiscipline of soil ecology, and which is an approach that actually, very often you'll hear that this is a new approach to soil life. In fact, it is not new at all. It has existed at least since the early 20th century, but it has been largely downplayed and marginalized in the second half of the 20th century. And Lola has also said a few things about that. So for most of the second half of the 19th century, the attention to soil biology has persisted in, you could say, alternative realms of agriculture, gardening, and so on, before it was taken back, so to speak, within more mainstream trends of the soil sciences. Now, why I think this living perspective, which is not only scientific, is so interesting in regards to the environmental humanities attempt to decenter human agency, is not just the attention to the many living beings that thrive in soil, but rather the relational perspective that unfolds from this attention. That's why I have my title for this talk is The Urban Meshwork. So just to explain how I personally learned this, because I didn't do, I don't have a master in soil science. I have a master in anthropology and then did my PhD in social science research teams. I basically learned this doing fieldwork with a French soil ecologist called Manu Blouin, whom I was basically shadowing in his daily task to try to understand how he understood soil himself and how it related to him in his daily research activity. And one day we went to a forest with Manu to try to find some earthworms that he needed for an experiment in his lab. And we started digging this rich forest soil. And at some point he took a lump of soil, the one you've got in the picture here, shown it to me and told me, look, this is really what I call soil. And basically what he showed me was this mix of decomposing leaves, these insect larvae and predators crawling in the soil. But most importantly for him were these little lumps of soil that you can see sticking in these roots if you look close enough. And those are aggregates. So basically there are little lumps of organic and mineral material that stick together thanks to the action of roots, of bacteria, of earthworms that digest soil particles and that bound these particles together, thereby providing the conditions for life to thrive in this soil. So basically what this really showed was that soil is not just a mix of materials and chemical properties, but a milieu that holds and grows because of this living web. So it's a really good place, I think, to think about joint processes of joint becoming. So how things grow together rather than isolated. That also speaks, I think, to what Serge mentioned in the introduction when he said, we need not to think of soil as just one compartment within this larger web of life. But the social sciences very often still view soil as a resource exterior to humans, something proposed by nature and of which humans dispose, if you will, a perspective that is very much in line with reductionist accounts of hosts of soils in the natural sciences and agronomy, of post-war agronomy mainly. So one possible way forward to overcome this dualism where soils are just relegated to the background is suggested by the so-called pragmatist research tradition, which builds on the work of James Dewey, with the notion of attachment. And Nadia, you mentioned the notion of affect, so I'm guessing maybe we mean the same thing by this. The notion of attachment points to the fact that human activities, whether we want it or not, are also bonded to this architecture of web and filaments. They're not exterior to the environment, they're taking up in relations of co-becoming. That's what the pragmatists mean with attachment. We're taking up in a relationship that is mutually transformative. Transforming soils also means changing the socials, the social. The two go hand in hand. Now, let us turn to the very peculiar relationship that modern Western people have developed with soils in urban areas, especially in Europe over the past two centuries. So from this conception of soil as a meshwork of life, which I try to take as my way of, as a, the way I will use to think of a soil-human relationships in the following, how can we make sense of urban relations to soils? Precisely in this European context, where we tend to think of soil as something more rural, linked to the countryside, but not really to cities. So this is just a map that I think is quite explicit to show how urban soils have been neglected in modern approaches to soils and cities, to the extent that apart from parks and a few gardens, it is difficult to see the city as a place where soils are present. This is a map of the soils of France published in 1998 by the French INRA, so the National Agronomic Institute. And among the different categories of soils, which are, they have more than that, this is a simplification, there is this gray zone of non-soils, which corresponds to the surfaces of lakes, glaciers, and cities. So what I like to do in this part is to reflect on the history of that rift between soils and cities, because it is actually situated in time and not in a very, very long time span. To understand this, we can turn to historians such as Sabine Barl, André Guillerme, or Martin Melazé in English, who have studied the motives and techniques underlying the development of urban infrastructures in the 19th century Europe. So what they show is that until the 19th century, urban soils were not that clearly separated from the rest of soils and from wider nutrient loops. Urban manure or night soil, which was basically horse excrements, animal, human excrements, as well as shit, if you will, mixed with food residues and other kind of residues, was collected or scraped from pavements to fertilize the fields, with peri-urban market gardeners coming to downtown markets with a cart full of vegetables to be sold and leaving with a cart full of this manure to be spread on the fields. So the soils of the Seine-Saint-Denis department, just outside Paris, the soils of Heathrow Plain near London have all been fertilized like that for a long time. And of course, many others as well. It's just that these two have been documented well. So what these historians show is that the processes of sedimentation, decay, decomposition, dissolution, etc., all this vitality of urban, of soil basically, and of the materials that make them up, attracted a lot of attention and a whole economy depending on them in this not so far away past. But in the 19th century, the Industrial Revolution and revolutions in the plural actually, and the urbanization that came with it radically transformed food production and consumption practices in Europe, as well as representations of hygiene, nature, and space. So this is a time when sewer networks, stone pavements, and waste collection systems became generalized, became seen as a basic requirement for cities, basically, while the development of transportation means based on fossil energy allowed food to come from faraway places. And this is also the point at which what is referred to as the urban seal the covering of soil with a hard surface of stones or asphalt and concrete later on became generalized. And the history of this, I think, is really interesting. Beyond the fears of urban reformers about the miasma and the urban stench and their obsession with aeration, drainage, and then the creation of this smooth, impermeable and inorganic surface for cities, we can also in parallel reposition this history within a wider history of representation of so-called modern man as a cosmopolitan individual that is abstracted from the ground, from the soil. So this is an image that is super well known, but I've just used it here from an article by Tim Ingold, where he examines Victorian representations of hominization, so how humans basically developed into humans over the course of their evolution, and shows this kind of march of progress of man that stands up and thereby thinks, becomes master of his body. And now consider this quote by Alexandre de Laborde, which I quote, which comes from an article by Swiss historian David Ripoll, who in 1818 pleaded by the city before a Paris City Council to install modern paving on the sidewalks. And I'll translate it for those of you who don't speak French. Busy people, no longer having to concentrate their attention on the stones they have to walk on, will be able to think freely about their interest and their business and thereby raise their minds. And Ripoll notes that this policy of pavement also gave rise to the Baudelairean flâneur, the detached wanderer, whom Walter Benjamin saw as the archetypal figure of modern urban experience, a pedestrian in the crowd who is a kind of captain of his own body, who can walk unaffected by the ground because the ground has been made into this smooth surface, and thus think only of the higher occupations of trade and the detached contemplation of the world. So what this tells us is that the modern impetus for civilization has also come hand in hand with civilizing the soil, cutting it from the climate and the wider metabolic processes by building this hard layer and thereby making it just ground where only human interaction can take place. So we see here how human exceptionalism and the history of whole modernity has sought to silence the living world, to transform it into a simple background for human history, a reserve of mute things and resource at hand. We see how this history peers through how the city has been conceptualized and made effectively into a soil-free space. And this also resonates, of course, with how agricultural soils have been treated in the 20th century, as Lola has mentioned, but that's a slightly different story. So one thing to remember is that this hard surfacing of urban soils participates in the perpetuation of the modernist conception of the territory as a blank page for appropriation, a simple homogeneous leveled terrain, broadly devoid of texture, which requires no attention in itself, but is just there as space for the emergence of new social and urban forms. So I've started here by questioning the processes of opacity and visibility of soils, of urban soils, and linking them to certain conceptions of the urban subject, of cognition, of relationship to the environment. And the next question, of course, is what happens when urban soils start gaining more attention again, as it seems to be the case today. So remember the soil map that I showed you about these urban soils, showing these urban soils as non-soils. Well, it dates from 1998, and we have come a long way since then. In the past 30 years, urban pedology or the urban soil sciences have developed into a full-fledged scientific field, which notably resulted in new soil categories being defined to describe these urban soils or other kinds of highly anthropogenic soils, in fact. In 2006, the category of technosol made its way into the WRB, which is the international referential for soil types. Basically, it's a soil classification system. It's a key for describing different kinds of soils. And it's edited by the International Union of Soil Scientists and the FAO. So it's basically the principal, on par with the American key, because the Americans have their own system, one of the principal scientific reference to describe soils. And this category of technosol made its way into it. And what it encompasses is basically every soil that that contain over 20% of human artifacts, so such as bricks, pipes, concrete, slag, and so on. So human influence plays an overwhelming role in the development of these soils. And a number of research projects started to address these soils specifically, sometimes called SWITMA, for soils of urban traffic mining areas. And the goal of this research has largely been to categorize, to characterize and map these urban soils in order to explore how they function, how water moves through them, for example, how roots come to explore pieces of concrete, of plastic, what kind of soil fauna can dwell in these very specific soils where you don't necessarily find the earthworms and this sort of creatures usually associated to soils. And the illustration here on the screen from three of these, Morel is actually one of the most famous urban pedologists in France, shows a typology based on the so-called naturalness of these soils and their level of disturbance. Because depending on the urban context and occupation, the soil may have been partially or completely, partially or completely lost its original qualities. So just to give you one more example of this, here you see, you've got the category of technosoil, but then you've got qualifiers that allow to really describe more finely all these kind of soils. So on the left, you've got the garbage technosoil coming from the English garbage. That's basically a soil that developed from a waste dump from a landfill. On the right, you've got an ekranic technosoil from the Russian ekran, which is the same as in écran in French. Basically, this is a sealed soil. So a lot of the sidewalls you're walking on, you're actually walking on an ekranic technosoil. And the layer on top, the asphalt layer, is described as technic hard rock. But so that's just an example to show how these naturalistic categories are, are extended to the kind of environments that are completely produced by humans. Now, does this mean that the recent interest for urban soils necessarily mean that an ecological perspective on soils as a web of relations in which human activities participate is now prevailing? Certainly not. In fact, a lot of this research has been directed to evaluating the ecosystem services that these soils bring to humans, seeing urban soils as a kind of green infrastructure that can be benchmarked in a quasi-economical reasoning. While at the same time, these scientists have put a lot of effort in trying to design technosoil from scratch, so to actually engineer these soils so as to respond to the demands of urban planners who are in a dire need of fertile earth, as green cities with lots of trees and green spaces and so on seem to be the new leitmotif of urban planning. Let me see if I've got, one of the events that links to this that I'm trying to, just to say this example of one urban infrastructure like this, it's basically a green thread, what you would call a une trame verte in the Paris area. This needs immense amounts of soils to be built because there are no soils in the first place, usually when they implement these kind of things. This soil is basically the top layer that Lola was mentioning. It is scraped from agricultural fields that are in the process of being urbanized, of being built upon. So basically, when you see something like that, you can also think that several agricultural fields needed to be destroyed basically to actually have the material to do this. And the Paris area is actually, and it's not the only one in Europe, but is actually encountering what is sometimes referred to as an earth crisis, which refers to both a shortage in this fertile earth for building green infrastructure, because urbanization isn't going fast enough, apparently, but also to a lack of outlets for the 45 million cubic meters of fill material, so not soil, but deeper ground materials that are being excavated by current works to expand the metro system. I'd be really curious to know if you guys in Brussels have the same kind of problem, since you're also expanding your metro system. So legally, this fill used to fall in the waste category, which meant it had to be placed into a landfill. It couldn't move from a landfill. It was waste legally. But the law changed last year, allowing it to be framed as a resource. And the waste management corporate sector is now using ecological engineering techniques or technosol design to try to turn part of this fill into generic soil materials that can be sold to fill the containers in which urban trees are planted. So here you see unfolding all the dreams of green extractivism that view cities as a mine of materials, which once again objectify urban soils as a material unit, a resource for extraction, treating it as a physical support to develop green spaces and urban plantations, and completely ignoring that soils are busy relational space. So what might be the ways to relate to these soils without seeing them directly as a blank page for appropriation or a resource? And that will be my last part. And I'd like to refer here to the notion of latent commons, which has been put forward by Anna Tsing in her 2015 book, The Mushroom at the End of the World. And in this book, she insists on this importance of interspecies collaborations as an absolute condition for survival in what she calls the ruins of capitalism. But collaboration for her is indeterminate. It involves an attachment in the pragmatist sense I highlighted earlier that changes the parties involved in ways that cannot be foreseen. And this, the fact that this cannot be foreseen, is what creates the diversity, you could say, to follow what Lola was saying, the biocultural diversity in the world. So it runs counter the homogenizing forces of modernism and the capitalistic ecologies, which she denounces in that book. And to Tsing, we need to detect, and this is a quote, we need to detect the traces of not yet articulated common agendas, end of quote. And that's what she calls these latent commons. Latent commons for her are sites of collaboration, so commons, but they are latent because they remain underdeveloped and difficult to notice. So she goes on explaining that to seek allies, we need to practice arts of noticing. And an inspiration for me in what might be these arts of noticing comes from my fieldwork with urban gardeners, and I'll introduce you to them. I'll introduce them to you, right now. I did ethnographic fieldwork in Paris with them between 2014 and 2018. The guy you see on the left is Henri Taïb. He's an artist and gardener who lived in an abandoned building on the also abandoned Petite Ceinture railway in Paris until he was evicted in 2018. And on the disused railway tracks that you see behind him, he cultivated a garden with Leo, who you see on the right, who is an activist and gardener who had set up the local guerrilla gardening groups. And when I say they cultivated a garden there, I mean that they actually cultivated the soil of that place in the first place. So these gardeners, just to understand the kind of mode that they were into, were, I think, representative of what Chiara Certoma calls critical urban gardening, which works at reclaiming parts of the city, both in the sense of occupying private areas to make them public again, and in the sense of actually restoring the ecologies of these places, here in the sense of ecological reclamation. It's difficult to translate this word reclamation in French to have both these meanings sticking to it. So Henri showed me the picture of the place when he arrived in the 1980s, which obviously is not the picture you see here on the screen. I just couldn't find the one he showed me, so sorry about that. And he described the mineral world he lived in. He said there was no soil in sight, only solid mineral surfaces well maintained for decades by regular glyphosate treatments. So this kind of surface or space is typical of what Christian Simonetti calls surfaces of empire. So you have compacted ballast on the tracks, asphalt on the platforms. So for Simonetti, this surface of empire is this supposedly abiotic ground intended only to facilitate walking. Because it remains solid, does not slip, is odorless, asphalt is seen as a civilizing force. It serves the ambition to silence all forms of non-human life that I was mentioning earlier. By the time he met Leo, which I think was in 2008, the asphalt had started to crumble and weeds had grown all around the place. So they started observing what was happening, looking at the plants and wondering how they, what had brought them there, witnessing also how an organic layer, soon host to worms and ants, started to form upon and in the cracks of the anthropogenic rock surface. Then they started intervening, first by bringing plants they found elsewhere in the city to their gardens, trying to reproduce the growth condition where they had found them. This led them to pay attention to where soil growth was taking place in the city, such as on roofs of some buildings, in the cracks of walls, between pavements, and in every place the maintenance work of urban surfacing gave way. So their art of noticing, if you want, starts by completely opening up the category of soil. Anywhere you find something growing works as soil for them, basically. So by doing this, they started also by actually replicating these conditions in a kind of experimental fashion, you could say, in their gardens. They started experimenting with soil construction techniques, but not in the sense of trying to reproduce some kind of generic soil. Rather, they experimented with highly specific place-bound techniques to see if they could approach the ecological conditions of a gutter filled with decomposed leaves, for example, or those of a crack in a brick wall. And just one example to show how they did this in practice is what they call, what you see on the picture, which they called a boat. So basically, this is a soil construction technique that they experimented with and which has its roots in their attention to the kind of relational networks that constitute a soil. And this is basically inspired by two distinct set of techniques that they're bringing together within this specific technique. The first comes from permaculture. Basically, it's the idea of lasagna bed, which I'm sure lots of you are familiar with. So basically gathering organic waste in the neighborhood, arranging them into layers of green or brown, nitrogen or carbon-rich, dry or humid material. And all of this soon starts to break down with the help of water, bacteria and fungi, and to settle into a rich organic compost. But the second and arguably more original inspiration for this were dry stone walls. So dry stone walls are a kind of wall typical of the rural regions of southern France and actually throughout the Mediterranean world, where it has long been used to cultivate and stabilize mountain slopes. So these walls, and basically what you see around these trees is exactly that, are made of stones that are assembled only by fitting the shape of the stones together, but without the use of cement, and that's why it's called dry stone. So you have to find a kind of equilibrium and this between the stones, and this requires fine-tuning of the builder's eyes and hand. In the mountains where they originate, these walls are built with stones removed from the fields while working the soil, but the manufacturing process is the same in Leo's case, even though the stones here are technogenic, they are pieces of crumbled concrete, brick, and asphalt. And what is, I think, really beautiful about this technique is that there isn't only an equilibrium between the stones, but also with the soil inside the wall and with the tree or plant that grows in it, as the root system of the plant allows the wall and the soil to hold together, while the stone's porosity allows water to pass through and provide a habitat for insects. By so doing, the dry stone wall mirrors the conditions of the cracks in concrete buildings in which the urban wild plants that Leo and Henri observe normally grow, but at the same time, it doesn't just act as a container, it is a full part of the development of the soil, as are the plants, insects, and the hands and eyes of the gardener. So for Leo and Henri, to grow a soil means to resonate with the strange ecology of the place and to amplify it. These practices are simultaneously about knowledge of the soil processes, but also about skilled gardening practice. And this dry stone construction does not separate plant gardening from soil building or even from architecture in a way. And I think this makes it very inspirational. Finally, it links to a reappropriation, a reclamation of urban spaces and processes, since following the cycles of decomposition and recomposition of these materials also brings them into a political process of setting conditions for life in these ruined places. So it is, soil here is neither a blank page nor a resource, but something which we can engage with, a site where to inquire both on or mingling with the world of soil and on existing and possible future urban soil entanglements. And that's it for me. Thank you very much.